And good evening. It's a pleasure to be talking with you. Again, we had our first conversation in Missouri in the Himalaya, and it was a good introduction, and I'm very happy to have this follow-up.
What's the funniest thing that's happened to you on a Yeti hunt?
Well, funny, you don't have many funny things happening on Yeti hunts, but you get funny ideas. For instance, let's say you meet a Yeti in the middle of the jungle. What do you do? Do you shoot it? Do you get down and worship it? Do you try to tranquilize it? But let's say you meet a Yeti, and you've been searching and searching, and all of a sudden the Yeti is standing there. It's a question. Or let's say you capture the animal in a trap. Do you give it a room in a hotel? Do you put it into a five-star hotel? Or do you put it in a zoo and lock it up in a cage? I mean, these are real questions if you're a serious Yeti hunter. And then the next type of funny thing that could come to you is the colleagues that you work with. And in our case, after many decades of work, as I describe in the book, I walk back into the most important village, which is a very poor village, at the confluence of the Arun and Barun rivers. And the shikaris, the old hunters that I've been working with for many years before, I hadn't seen them for two decades in this case, because I'm talking about a recent trip when I went back. And then they got angry at me because all the tourists who are coming are going on a different road, and they're not coming to their village so that they're getting the business. But this is what was funny. The greeting habit among these people in this particular tribe, which are called Lumi, the tribe of people, they greet each other by you hit your forehead, one person to the next. Instead of shaking hands, it's head to head.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's fine if it's one person, but I'm one person and there are 18 people there. So I suddenly get a terrific headache because I have to hit my head against their head 18 times. And they're trying to show me that they respect me so that they hit me especially hard. So there are, you know, it's the question of what is funny depends on on many situations. I mean, you know, the other question is, how do you build a Yeti trap? Nobody has ever successfully built a Yeti trap. And so I said, well, you don't really want to trap the Yeti because you might hurt it. We don't know, you know, with some sort of physical thing. So we want to get its footprints. So I think about this and I say, well, you know, maybe the way to do it is to take a can and to put peanut butter inside it, because peanut butter seems to be the universal bait for animals. If you're ever in doubt about a bait, peanuts seem to have a very strong odor, mashed peanuts that attract animals, and bears in particular and other animals with strong noses will come to the smell. Well, so you hang peanut butter in tin cans above where the snow that the Yeti will leave its footprints in. And I sort of have to laugh. Pretty funny that I'm going to use peanut butter in tin cans on strings, and then I look at the footprints underneath. So it's, you know, there. I can't give you the funniest things, but sometimes I end up seeing that the funniest thing is actually myself.
Fair enough. So after spending 27 years looking for a Yeti, you know, what exactly is a Yeti?
There are several types of Yetis. First of all, there is a real Yeti because we have real footprints. And there are many ideas that people think are animations. And in the word in Hindi, of course, is bhoot for a ghost. But the problem with most of these is that they never leave any evidence. Ghosts, boots, spirits, these sorts of things, we may believe they're real, but we don't have any physical evidence. And with the Yeti, the important thing is we have physical evidence. It's the footprint. that has been found for over 100 years in the snows of the Himalaya Mountains.
Right.
And the question then becomes, what is the animal that makes the footprint? And that, in my book, I have now conclusively explained as the bear, the Himalayan black bear, which is Ursus arctis tibetanus, the scientific name for it. And it is fairly aggressive. But this particular bear, when it is a juvenile and living in the trees, because it's living in the trees, it distorts its inner digit on its paw, so it looks like a hand. Now, that's one Yeti, the Yeti that is a bear. But there's another Yeti that is also very real. And that is the Yeti that people want to believe in. It's a spirit that is our human connection for the wild. And it is our ancestor, the missing link. It's the still living in pristine nature. And this is, to my mind, is sort of like Hanuman, the Hindu god. Was Hanuman an actual monkey? Or is Hanuman the idol that represents the connection of people to the pristine natural world? And it depends on your understanding of Hinduism. It depends on your understanding of idols. But to my mind, the Hanuman, for instance, is sort of a different manifestation of the Yeti. Mm-hmm. And we have these jungle men. We call them Sasquatch or Bigfoots in North America. The Russians have them in the Caucasus. And so what I'm saying is, and that I describe it in the book, there are really two Yetis.
Tell us something about the Mountain Institute and some of the work that you've done through it.
Right. Well, I founded the Mountain Institute, and I led it for 20 years. Uh-huh. And we created a series of national parks, and those national parks were distinctive because instead of hiring professional wardens to manage the parks, as is done in most of the national parks of India or around the world since the first national park, which was Yellowstone in the late 1800s in the United States, these new national parks that we created used people as partners. Mm-hmm. So the local villagers were made co-managers of the nature preserve. Mm-hmm. And instead of nature being strictly protected, these people as co-managers were also taking care of the land and advancing the quality of their life. Subsequent to my leadership of the Mountain Institute, I created Future Generations University, www.future.edu on the web. And what this does, and I've been leading that now for 25 years, is to teach people how to do this type of conservation. In the first projects at the Mountain Institute, we set them up. But now with Future Generations University, we're teaching people how to do appropriate conservation management. We're teaching both the people themselves and governments and also scientists. Mm-hmm. So let me give a specific example for India. In India, there is a group of people called the Gurjars,
yes,
who are Muslim migrants, go through the Himalayan foothills. And the government has decided that they're damaging the environment, so that the government's pushing the Gurjars out. Well, actually, the Gurjars can be the best managers of the jungle if they get some training. And the government needs to get some training. And so with the work of Future Generations University, what we're doing is to show how the Gurjars do not need to be pushed out of the jungle and can learn how to manage the jungle, and the government can use them as partners rather than what is happening now, which is confrontation between the people and the government. And we're seeing this problem all across India, in Arunachal Pradesh, mm-hmm, in Jharkhand, in Maharashtra, where we have tribal people who are living with the jungle, who could be stewards of the jungle if they had received the new type of training. And their quality of life would improve, and the jungle would improve. And so that's what I'm trying to do with Future Generations University.
Right. And do you face a lot of resistance when, you know, you actually tell people about this idea?
The answer is that if we don't do this, the wild will lose, and so will people. We'll lose on both sides, because the old model of confrontation simply does not work. And it works for small pockets, but it doesn't work for the whole planet. And right now we are on a whole planetary journey. So related to your question of resistance, mm-hmm. I think that everybody from the villager to a cabinet minister understands that we are all in a new age of a one planet, one nature. Maybe not all the ministers of India's government, but there are a few.
Right.
And people understand that this is a new need. They don't understand yet how to do it. And this is what is very exciting for me, is that we have actually shown how to do it. We've shown how to do it in India, most successfully actually in Arunachal Pradesh, mm-hmm. which has more wilderness than any place else, and it has also more tribal populations. We've shown how to do it in Nepal. We've shown how to do it in Tibet. We've shown how to do it in the United States, and we've shown how to do it in places like Haiti, which is otherwise considered a very poor and backward country, but it actually is doing this. And if the when India changed its laws on forest management from where the government owned the trees to where communities could own their trees and community forest management, we have now examples. And so what we need to use is these examples to break down your question of resistance. For me to sit as a professor and say, do this, makes no sense at all. But to use the examples that are in India, in places like Arunachal, or in places all over India, in the community forestry projects, we can scale those up and extend them to tigers, and we can extend them to crocodiles, and we can extend them to the birds.
Sure.
And then we hold recovery of the vulture in India. There's lots of interesting opportunities.
Right. So with respect to, the Makalu Barun National Park that you established.
Right.
What was it like when you first went there? And how has it transformed when you went there recently?
It's an excellent question, and it's one that brings me personally great joy. Mm-hmm. When I first went there, it was such dense jungle and so pristine that even the villagers who lived near it seldom went into it. Only the most courageous shikaris, pardon me, I got a cough here. Only the most courageous shikaris went inside. Mm-hmm. And the people were slowly starting to cut down the trees along the edges to make fields for especially maize, but other agricultural crops. So the jungle was clearly going to slowly get smaller and smaller, as from the bottom side, people were making fields, and from the top side, villagers were coming in and making it into grazing for sheep and their yak.
Right.
Burning out the trees. Now, what has happened is that with the Nature National Park, the people are learning that there's two things. First of all, they're learning that the having the jungle there brings tourists. And so they're getting diversifying of their economy. But secondly, in certain selected management areas, people are using the trees as shade, and they're growing very valuable crops in underneath the leaves, such as cardamom, such as ginger, which they can make much more money from than they could from maize. So by leaving the tree, they're using the ground underneath. And this has to be carefully managed, because there are ground plants and animals and whatnot that need to be protected. But the people are seeing that having the jungle there is helping them in very tangible ways. Mm-hmm. And one thing I want to say about the Makalu Barun is that when we first got the idea of creating the Makalu Barun project, and I described this in the Yeti book at some length, we understood we had to have a meeting. You always have to have meetings, right? Governments make decisions, they have to have a meeting, they have to have everybody come to the meeting.
Sure.
And then you get bureaucrats. Well, I got the idea that let's not have the meeting in a hotel room with tea and biscuits, or even whiskey and nice meat, okay? We don't do the normal type of meeting. let's take the helicopter and fly everybody, government ministers, members of the royal family, international scientists, out into the jungle. And so we had a meeting, what's called the Saldima Conference, in 1984. Mm-hmm. And we talked about this idea. And because we were meeting inside the jungle, we were thinking in a different way. One's thoughts are changed by where you're having the meeting. If you're sitting in a five-star hotel, it's a different type of meeting than if you're sitting in a dhaba by the side of the road.
No, interesting.
And if you're sitting, you're not necessarily going to have a better decision in a five-star hotel. And so in this case, we came up with the idea of a participatory approach with the jungle, with the people, with the villagers, even the illiterate people, and the ministers. And this idea has now spread. It began at the Saldima Conference. It was spread to the Annapurna Conservation Project. It's now spread to national parks in Bhutan. It's spread in Tibet, China. It's spread in India in selected areas. As I've mentioned Arunachal, I want to just mention it again. It's one of the most interesting places for conservation in India. Mm-hmm. But it came because we had the meeting in the jungle, and not in the president's office or the prime minister's office or something like that.
Tell us something about the seed scale method that you talk about.
Well, thank you for the question, because I could give you a 2 years master's degree on the subject. seed scale is an interesting method that comes from a careful study of best practices all over the world. And basically, it shows how you can take successes that you have, and everybody has a success, otherwise it'd be dead. How you can take, and every village, every poor person has successes, mm-hmm. Such as their children or whatever, and how you can grow that into a better world, better life. So you don't need the government to give you schemes, because likely the government will never do that. The government will abandon you, probably. Most governments abandon you. They're poor people.
Right.
And so seed scale gives you a method of principles, and it gives you tasks that allow you to build a better future with what you have. For instance, instead of looking at your needs and saying, I'm poor, you look at your successes. So look at successes, not needs. Instead of listening to the powerful person who's there has opinions, you say, what is the evidence around me about what is working? I don't follow the basis of power. I'll follow the evidence. This is, for instance, a very Gandhian idea. Mm-hmm. Or it says, instead of trying to get some measurable deliverable, all I will work on is trying to improve my behaviors. Because if my behaviors improve, guess what? My health will improve.
Right.
Peace, conflict will go down. So seed scale teaches you how to use what you have to get to where you want to go.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Taylor, for spending time with us.
Well, it's my great pleasure, and maybe one day we will see each other sitting on the slopes in Missouri. You never know in this world.